Thank you so much.
And adjust that thing well.
Hello, hello. Hey, everybody, I'm Ryan, an alcoholic. And, I'm going to start this. It's good to be here. It's good to be sober. Is that too loud? It sounds really loud right here. It's good? All right. It's good to be here and be sober. Thanks, Oscar. Oscar asked me to do this so long ago, I forgot. I said yes. And then I got a letter in the mail. And who gets letters anymore? But thanks for sending me that letter that I lost and had to find again and got texted and the whole thing. But I drove down today. It was a nice drive. And it's good to be here. It's good to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. On the way down here, I listened to a couple speakers, a couple of my favorites, so I could kind of have a meeting before the meeting. And that's always helpful for me. So thanks to our last speaker, caught the tail end of that. I don't know about Jeeps, but I know about driving Silverados off the road at high speed, 70 miles an hour, breaking tires off both sides of the drivers. Should have rolled about 10 times, didn't. Drove it back on the road with two flat tires and into town and got a DUI. But the Silverado made it, so I'm all about Silverados. Sorry, Pat, I know you're a Jeep guy. I didn't drink today. It wasn't always that way, right? When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not go a day without drinking. I could not. That's just where I was at. I could not. I was drinking or thinking about drinking. I'm grateful to be here. I don't remember my first drink, but I remember my first drunk. And you know what I know about that is I felt the release that I think we all kind of talk about. I've heard talked about here. I don't know how you drink. I'll talk about how I drink. I know that when I drank, I felt something different. And it affected me. It changed the way I felt. And I didn't know that I would continue to chase that idea that anything that will change the way I feel, I'm all about it. And when I start something, I just get in there and I dig in really good. And I found out here in Alcoholics Anonymous that I'll do that with anything. And that because this thing centers in my head, when you take away the alcohol, I'll latch into something else to kind of fill that up. And so I know when I drank that, or when I got drunk that first time, I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop drinking. I ended up, I was punching holes in the walls. I was probably 12 or 13, and I felt really strong, and I felt all empowered. It gave me this courage that I didn't know I was living in fear, and it gave me this courage, and I felt strong, and I ended up blacking out. And I came to the next morning with a really bad headache, a really dry mouth. My knuckles were shredded off the skin. And I would feel like that a lot, right? Like, that was my first hangover. It was my first blackout. And I didn't really ever drink any other way, right? I always drank for oblivion. And I didn't know that. excuse me. What I also know is that alcohol changed the way I feel before I ever drank it. My dad drank a lot. And so whenever there's alcohol poured on him, it affected the rest of the house. And so I knew that there was something happening there related to alcohol, but I didn't know what it was. And I didn't leave, pack up my bags and leave for Skid Row after that first drunk, but that would happen, right? It would happen eventually. As I grew up, another thing that I learned at that early age is that I felt a lot different than most people. And when I was a little bit younger, you'll hear me talk about my mom and my dad, and that was actually not my mom and dad. When I was younger, I witnessed the murder of my parents. It was a homicide. It was violent. And I was raised by my biological mom's sister. And I was grateful for that. And I was thinking recently that I was orphaned. And I was like, wow, that's a weird word to say, orphan. But that was the case. Kind of the early experience I had with that when I started to get some thoughts about what that meant to me was that people would ask me a lot how I felt, and I would say, fine. Are you good? I'm fine. And in time, what that taught me was how to lie. It taught me how to lie about the way I was feeling, about how I felt about you, and it taught me how to hide myself inside, and I had this duality happening where what was happening on the outside was not what was happening on the inside. And I would protect that. My ego would come in full force to protect that part of me. I drank to shield that. I drank to feel this courage that I didn't have because I was petrified of life. I was afraid you were going to leave me. That was my experience. I have really bad separation anxieties today because I'm afraid you're going to leave. So I don't want you too close. So I'll sabotage relationships so that you leave and I'll go, see? I didn't know all these kind of things as a language I didn't have. I couldn't articulate that then. But I know that that's when I started to learn to lie really, really good. And as I went through school, you know, there was always two sides of what was happening. I was really good in school. I was popular with kids, girls. I was quarterback of the football team. I did all those things. But inside, I was really super separated from what was going on around me. I don't remember a lot of childhood. I don't remember birthdays. I don't remember having a birthday. I don't remember a lot of Christmas. I was present, but I wasn't there. And that kind of happened a lot for me. And so anytime I could kind of change, and I know today that some of that depression and some of that stuff is just, you know, self-centeredness. And I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous that that's the root of my disease. I'm selfish and I'm self-centered and all I can think about is me. And when I put some alcohol in me or some whatever else you had, because I'm equal opportunity when it comes to alcohol and drugs, but when you put alcohol in me, it just kind of thins that veil of self-obsession long enough to where I can make a connection to you, and I don't care about that anymore, right? I don't care what you think about me. I don't care what I think about me, most importantly. And I can do all the other things that I see other people doing that I think that if I do that, I'll be okay. Like, I think I'll feel better if I can smile the way they're smiling or whatever the thing is. I'm constantly comparing the way I feel my insides to your outsides, and I can see, like, you're doing these things, and if I do those things, maybe I will too. But when I drink, I don't think about any of that. All that thinking goes away, and I just do. So that's how I drank. I drank whenever I could in high school and anything else we could get our hands on, whenever that was possible. Not every single day, but every opportunity I could, I would drink. And I would drink to get drunk. I would drink to get drunk. I thought that's what you were supposed to do. I thought falling around in the dirt, you know, I grew up in Bishop, we're burning tires out in the middle of the desert to stay warm. You know, you got to rotate around and your butt gets cold and you got to come back to the front. You share gloves with your partner because you got to have a beer hand and then one in your pocket because it's freezing. And then you wake up in the morning, you're just covered with toxic black rubber. And that was partying, right? That was fun in Bishop High School, I'll tell you what. But we drank a lot, and that's just what we did. And I didn't think about it any different than anybody else. I didn't know I was drinking different. I didn't know that I was thinking about drinking differently than anybody else. I just thought that's just the way it was. But that was a common thing for me. Like, I was in a church. I was raised in a church. I was an altar boy. And when I would look out at all you people, I would say those same prayers, and you would say those prayers, and I really thought that you guys were getting something that I wasn't getting. You guys are getting something. I don't feel the same way I think that you guys look. And that's a constant thing, a constant process in my head would be like, I don't feel like you do. And so I was always separate, even if I was surrounded by everybody, I always felt kind of separate. But again, I could lie and I could do all the things and make you think I was present. In high school, I did all of the things that they said to do except like take the SAT. That was a big thing back then. And I had a scholarship to play football and I had life figured out. And so I didn't take that SAT and I didn't take that scholarship. I went my own way. We had a plan, junior college. It was the 80s and, you know, I grew up in the mountains, so we went to the beach. And what I know about that is I never stepped foot on that junior college campus I said I was going to go to. Never enrolled. I still haven't been there. But I got a job at the beach. I was a lifeguard. And I failed out of school miserably because I couldn't leave the beach. I was partying. It was all the things. We'd go to Tijuana. It was all that stuff. And it just seemed to me at the time that I was just doing what everybody else was doing. But in time, that would reveal itself to not be true. I ended up in school eventually. Made it to school, and I got a good job doing network computing in the 90s. And, you know, I had a big house. And it was with a back house that we rented out in Pasadena. I had new cars in the front yard. We would take trips to Cabo, and I was in my 20s, and I thought, this is what it's about. And the example of alcohol in my house was, you know, my dad never, to this day, never got pulled over, never lost a job. You know, he owns his own home. He never got arrested. He never did any of those things. And so I felt as if, like, this is what I do. The drinking and the drugs and the whole thing was just part of what I did. Like, I had earned that. Like, this is what you do. This is success. This is what we're supposed to be doing. And I was never more miserable in my life. And I talk about this part of my life because this is when I knew that I was showing up at work and hungover and using a lot of stimulants to get through those nights and days of fixing computers. And I was getting on airplanes because I was supervising the West Coast. It was a big network. It was global. And I was getting on airplanes, or I knew I would have a flight and I would wake up. I would be either on the plane or I might be in a different city, trying to figure out what city I was in. It was either Seattle, maybe it's Portland, I don't know. And I would do a bunch of drugs and I would fix all these computers all night long, and then I would fly on. But it was at this point in my life that I knew, I was 28, and I knew that I didn't want to drink, and I couldn't stop drinking. I consciously was aware, like, I'm not going to drink tonight when I get home. And I would come too drunk. And my truck would just drive itself to the liquor store. And I would just come too drunk. And that's when the first time I got, I was taken to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 28 years old, and I knew then without reservation that I was an alcoholic and a drug addict. That was not a problem for me to say. I knew. But I didn't know what that meant in here. I didn't know what the context was. I didn't know what to do about that. I recall going to that meeting. It was a mental facility, was what it was, BHC Alhambra Hospital. And I went to an outpatient meeting there and said I was an alcoholic. And I went to those meetings a couple times during the week, and I felt like relief, like, oh, I'm an alcoholic. But I would stop on the way home and get a half pint. Like, that's only a half pint. And I was still drinking. And I remember showing up to one of those meetings, and I'd gotten to know a few people. And the wife of one of the guys that was in the hospital said, wow, you look great. This is really working for you. And I thought, you know, I think I got a haircut. Or maybe I was still in my work clothes. And I just kind of looked a little different, but I had not stopped drinking. So I'm like, oh, I thought I was just learning how to drink. And then it dawned on me that, you know, that's when, like, my chapter three began, where I really tried to just manage alcoholism and manage my drinking and see if I could just get by on doing that. And I couldn't. What would happen for me then would be, you know, chapter three was all these non-spiritual ways to try to quit drinking that I could insert into my life. All the geographics. I would lose the house, the home, the girl, that job. And then for the next probably 12 years, 13 years, I would try to control my and enjoy my drinking. And it never was good after that, because I'd come and I met all you shiny people that I couldn't connect with, that I didn't believe you understood how I drank. There's no way. You people had seen what I seen and did what I did. You know, that separation thing, I would sit in the back and not be present at all. I was in a meeting last night, and we were talking about listening and as a topic. And what dawned on me is that I couldn't hear what was happening here. I thought I knew everything. I came full of, you know, ego and pride, but I had this victim mentality, and I had this understanding of what I think I thought I knew, and that you could never understand those things. And I couldn't hear what was happening here for a long time. And I couldn't connect with the message that you were trying to give me, because all I could think about was what I was going to tell you about, right? Like, if you ever find yourself hearing in a conversation and all you want to do is say something, that's how I felt in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was full of what I could tell you about my life and why I wasn't going to do what you're going to do, why I continued to do the things I did, justify, rationalize my drinking. But I couldn't hear what you guys were saying for the longest time. You should talk to my daughter. I don't hear what she says most of the time still. But I had to learn to do that. I had to empathize. I had to learn to feel that and understand that what you were saying, that it connected to me, and I didn't know that. You know, I did the things. I had a kid, thought that was going to change my life. I was present at her birth. I was the first person to hold her, and I thought, oh, this is going to do it. This is going to do it. It did not do it. And about 5 short years later, I was in and out of jail. I was starting to become unemployable. I took a gig at a golf course because I could drink everybody's junk on the golf course, like, first thing in the morning. And that worked really well for me. because I would be hammered driving around a lawnmower in a golf course, like, and everybody else is hammered. So it was perfect. I turned away better jobs, much better jobs, full time, all the things, so I could stay at the golf course. I took jobs in construction because everybody drinks in construction. Right? I was lowering all that, the friends, the drinking, all of that. I was putting myself in a position to hang out with the people that drank like me. Because if you didn't drink like me, I didn't stick around much, you know. I didn't want to stick out. I was super angry. I didn't know that was fear. And so what started to happen is all this stuff started to boil up. I was listening to Sharon C. talk about the big whale and how all these things of my past, like all the stuff I would stuff down, all the people I had hurt and all the harm I had caused and all the things that I would do to stay drunk. You know, you get to Alcoholics Anonymous and you hit the brakes and it all just comes flying forward. And I kept drinking harder to stay away from that stuff. I would go to rehab after rehab to keep the drug, to keep the court happy, thinking that was going to help. And while I'm in the rehab, I learned how to do all the things you do. I got a sponsor with a name, get my card signed, and jump through all the hoops. But now I'm spending more and more time in jail, so I'm a little institutionalized. I know how to do all that stuff. But I would get out because I don't have a program. Within a month, I would be drunk. And I would go back to the same rehabs. And it's during this time of my life when I realized that, I really need to drink, because now it's become like the primary focus of my life. I was in and out of meetings and in and out of jail and in and out of rehab, and things are looking grim. But instead of like addressing what I had to do here in Alcoholics Anonymous or any other place, I just, chose to be homeless, essentially. I had been on and off the streets a lot because I would rather just go out there. I'd get kicked out and I would just stay out. But I began to do that more and more as a lifestyle as time went on. Because I got to drink. And now because I don't have a job, I got to steal. And if that, you know, and eventually if that means from you, then I'm going to do that. What I became willing to do to stay drunk and loaded towards the end of my drinking was desperate, and it was violent, and it was ugly, and I'm not proud of that, but that's the way I drink. You know, that's the way I was drinking at the end of my drinking. I was homeless, and whatever I had to do to drink was going to happen. I was thinking about this time that, we just checked in the hotel. Thanks for hooking that up, whoever did that. Kathy G, I think, is, I don't know if she's here. She said she got sick. But we're at the hotel, my friend that came, she spilled some water on her shirt she's going to wear, and she had it laying on the cooler that's in the hotel rooms. And it reminded me of the time I got kicked out of a rehab in Pasadena, and it was raining. All I had was the clothes on, and it was raining so hard I was wet, like through my clothes to my skin for like 2 days. And all I could do was walk to Vaughn's and like, you know, I was pushing a shopping cart through Vaughn's Shopping like I was going to get food, and I was just stealing a bottle of vodka, and I would eat while I was going up and down aisles throwing stuff in the cart like I'm shopping, and I'm eating that food, and I walk out with a couple bottles of vodka because I got a drink. I'm drenched. My feet are squeaking. And I got stuck in Pasadena for like 2 weeks. But I got into a motel room, and I put all my clothes on top of that little heater, hoping it was going to dry. And I curled up naked in the bed, and I was just shivering violently all night. And those clothes didn't dry. And I put those wet clothes back on and went out in the street the next day. And I didn't get home for another couple of weeks. That was the bus story. Remember the bus story? I couldn't get on the bus, man. I was drinking so hard that, like, the guy at the bus stop was like, I'd bought this ticket. Went from Pasadena to Glendale, buy a ticket in Glendale to go home to Bishop on the Greyhound. And the guy, he pulls up in the bus, and I got a ticket. And he's like, you're not getting on my bus. Look at you. I'm like, I have a ticket. He's like, you're not getting on the bus. I'm like, what am I going to do? I do what I had already known to do, is I hung around that bus stop for a little while. I slept in the gutter next to a retaining wall behind an auto shop that was across the street. And when I woke up that morning, I was violently ill because I'm addicted physically to alcohol, and I need to drink. And I'm like, oh, well, the bus isn't coming till 3, and it's 6. I got time. And I go get a fifth, and by the time that bus came, I was hammered again, and he wouldn't let me on the bus. This went on for 4 days. He would show up, and I'd be like, ugh! And I'd get up in the next morning, and that's what my drinking was like. Drinking, you know, dreaming, drinking, and dying every day, because every day I wake up like, okay, today's the day I'm going to get out of this gutter. I'm going to go do the thing I need to do, but I got to drink. And by this time, the way I'm drinking, it could be a day, it could be 5 days, it could be a half pint that gets me drunk. I could drink 3/5 and nothing happened. It was just unpredictable. Nobody knew what was going to happen, least of all me. I did eventually make it home, and it stayed there for about a month, and I ended up back in the rehab again. And I didn't last long in that rehab. I got drunk, and I got thrown out. And eventually, you know, and I went back home and tried to do the thing again, and try to convince everybody that this time is going to be different. And they all knew. Like, there was nothing I could say anymore. There was no, I'm sorry. Nobody believed me. I didn't even believe me anymore. I just didn't believe me. I'm like, oh, this is what I'm going to do. I'm just going to drink myself to death. And, you know, the book talks about that this spiritual life or this lonely alcoholic death. And I'm like, I think I'm going to drink myself to death. But I was homeless for a number of years in Bishop, and it's cold up there. And, you know, and I would do the thing where, you know, downtown Bishop, and I'd wake up in the middle of these fields down there, and I would jump in the canal and shake it all off, and I'd walk to Vaughn's. And I'd do the same thing I was doing for years now, if I'm honest. I would go in there and I would buy a little bit of food and I'd stuff a fist down my pants and the lady would check me out and she'd be like, Ryan, I saw your little girl. You need to get your ass home. Today's the day. I'm on my way there. And I'd walk back into the park and before I got even in the park, I'd be drinking that fifth and again, not knowing what was going to happen. Like, I might get arrested. I might have to come back in a couple hours. And still another fifth. And that's where I was. It was during this time that, I've had probably lots of moments of clarity where I'm like, this is not good. I should probably stop this. I probably should get some help. And I've been a lot at the bottom, whatever that means. I think, you know, if we talk about a spiritual bottom here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that ray of hope and that spiritual goodness in life and that whole, yay, life kind of got depleted and drained and sucked out of me when I was a kid after watching my parents die. I never really had that. I never grew up wanting to be anything. I never envisioned myself living through my 20s. You know, I just didn't really have any of that internally, and I probably struggle with that a little bit today. But what I know is one day in the park, I was sitting there drinking like any other day, and I was falling down, and I didn't know, but I was jaundiced, and I was yellow, and my liver was distended, and my ankles were swollen because I was filling with water because my kidneys were shutting down. And my little sister, whose house I had stopped going by because I didn't want to bother her anymore or steal her shit, really, let's be honest, I went there, and she fed me dinner. And she said, you really need to go to the hospital. I'm like, eh. I woke up in the morning like I do every morning, really early, violently sick, looking at their booze in the house. It was like, don't steal anything, don't steal anything. She got up at 5 and she's like, there's beer in the fridge. I'm like, I need the vodka. She gave me $5. She said, don't be sick. We cook dinner every night. And that was the first time I'd been invited back to my family's house in a long time. And so, that day I went back and I was drunk, and she had put a bucket by the couch and I had a blanket, and I stayed the night there again. And she said the same thing, like, we cook dinner every night, you really need to go to the hospital. The next day I fell down in a really bad way, and I went back to her and I said, tonight's the night, take me to the hospital. And when I did, they put me in the ICU for 3 days. And it was horrible. And what I know is when I woke up I was unconscious for 3 days, and they were filling me with fluids and all the drugs. I woke up, my dad was there waiting for me to come too. And I really wish I could tell you that was my sobriety date. It wasn't, because as soon as they kicked me out, I'm on Librium and I got a drink on top of that. But I knew then that I was going to die if I didn't drinking in that hole. Like, the knowing I didn't want to die was stronger than the fear of living sober. And then that was a moment where I'm like, okay, I got to go. She called a cousin who called her brother, and they were sober down south in the Pacific group. And he came and picked me up. And I was talking about it today. My last drink was in a Walmart parking lot right over here in Lancaster by the In-N-Out, because we were going to meet him at In-N-Out. And I slugged about half a bottle of vodka and smoked a bunch of Marlboros because I knew the gig was up. And I got into his car, my cousin's car. He had like 18 years at the time. And he took me to his house where I spent the night. And then he drove me downtown to Skid Row and dumped me off at the Midnight Mission. And when I went there, you know, when he drove away, I was just like, ooh, another place. I was probably still drunk. And nothing I was wearing was mine. I didn't have any clothes that were mine. The shoes I was wearing were like my brother-in-law's. They didn't fit me. I had a backpack full of stuff that wasn't mine, that had just been given to me. And he just left me in the lobby of that place. And I just, you know, I did what I was kind of programmed to do. I'm institutionalized. I'm like, okay, here's your bed. Check into your bed. Do this thing. Go get a job downstairs or do this. And then, you know, you can keep a bed. Stay sober. Da 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 da, and I'm like, okay, I got this. About 90 days into that, you know, because now, you know, the wrinkles come out of my stomach, and I'm like, I'm sober, right? I'm calling home, I'm running shit from a program in Skid Row. No, you know what I'm gonna do next? And what happened during that time was something I didn't plan. You know, we're going every night out to meetings. We're doing that thing, going to the big Wednesday night meeting, Sunday night Ohio, Monday night Ohio, 7 days a week we're going out there. And I was just going to get my card signed, if I'm honest. I wasn't planning on anything. I don't have it inside my head forever. I'm not sure what that means. So you tell me I'm never going to drink again, I don't know what that means. But about 90 days in-ish, over 30 days in, I went and saw my cousin at a meeting, because I know you guys. I'm not going to go to the meeting and say I'm new. I've been doing it for too long. Of course, they know exactly who you are, right? You come in on the big white van, you know, in clothes that aren't yours because they've been donated because you live in a mission in Skid Row. Like, no, you won't know. And I'm going to the West Side and saw my cousin there, and he's like, where's your sponsor? I'm like, and he introduced me to a guy, and I talked to him today on the way down. He's still my sponsor. And you know, and after years of being on the street and in jail and in rehabs, you know, I didn't trust any of you people. And here's a guy that I did not know. And I started to call and started to do what he was asking me to do. And I don't know why that happened. It wasn't my plan. I'd been around here long enough. But about it, you know, 90 days, because I was like, oh, I know how to do the deal here. I can quote the big book and da-da-da-da. And he wasn't interested in any of that crap. Not at all. And I had a little pocket big book I was waiting for, you know, to get him a good study. And he didn't care about any of that crap. He said, call me every day. And I would leave my little job at the mission and walk down to the patio and use a payphone in Skid Row. And I'd call him, and he never answered his phone. And I would see him, and I'd say, what? You don't ever pick up the phone. Why should I call you? And he said, I never said I was going to talk to you. I said, call me every day. And I'm like, yeah, you know. And so I had that little resentment thing going on, trying to learn how to take direction, trying to follow examples, trying to do what you were doing to get what you had. I wasn't sure if you had anything I wanted. And that's when kind of my perception started to change, and I started to call this guy, and about 90 days in, I got asked to share at a meeting, and he saw me after the meeting. He goes, you got 90 days? I said, yeah. So, whoa. So I'll read step one in the 12 and 12. I'm like, yeah, something to do. And then began this process in Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time that I was willing to do with somebody else, with a sponsor, by his direction. When he said to do something, I did something. I had done plenty of step work and rehabs, and I'd read the book several times, said I could do it myself. But it was the first time that I did what I was told to do when I was told to do it. And we started the process in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, I began to understand that, you know, I didn't want his hot wife or his money or his car or his anything. He had peace of mind. And I didn't know that that's what I was attracted to in him in the beginning. His sponsor was Frank. I listened to Frank, Frank Jones talk on the way down. And I'll never forget Frank. You know, I go to the big meeting and I'm there and there's lots, 900 people or whatever it is, and I'm in shorts. And Frank comes up to me and he goes, hey, he goes, why don't you go find that other guy with shorts and get his number? And I said, okay, Frank, I'm gonna do that. And I spent 20, 25 minutes going around that whole meeting, and there was nobody else in shorts. I was the only guy in shorts. He didn't tell me to wear pants, but I never went to that meeting again in shorts. I just never did. I'm like, okay, I see what's happening here. That's exactly what's happening here. And, you know, he did the same thing when I had it, when, you know, Clancy one time told me to put a collared shirt on. And 2 years sober, I've been doing it for a long time. I'm doing 7 meetings a week. I got, you know, commitments, my sponsors embedded in Alcoholics Anonymous there in that group. And I'm doing everything they do. I'm going to the yard. I'm going to the watches. I'm doing what they say to do in that group. And that was good for me. I needed that structure. I needed to just get along and follow along with what everybody else was doing. If I get too much rope, I'm going to use it. And so I was just doing that whole thing, and Clancy said, yeah, why don't you put a shirt on? I'm like, ooh, what's the deal with the shirt now? Like, 2 years sober, is that the magic time? And my sponsor said, that sounds about right. I'm like, and I looked around the room, and everybody who had a program that I respected had a collared shirt on. Nothing fancy, just a collared shirt. So I never went to that meeting again without a collared shirt. And those guys taught me a lot about what Alcoholics Anonymous was and what it wasn't, and it's not my home group anymore. I'd be in a suit today. God. Yeah, that's the way they roll. And it was how I rolled. That's what I was just doing when I was part of the group, part of the herd. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for those men in my life. I'm grateful for, you know, their example, service, you know, all those people that were doing that when I got there. I know that... So that whole peace of mind thing, I know some things have happened along the way in, you know, as a result of doing the steps. Obviously, I didn't know that I was protecting my whole life, this version of me that I kind of thought I understood and I didn't. Part of what I know now is that I found out who I was in the steps for real. And I kind of had an idea of that. That's why, you know, that's why I don't want to do a fourth step. I really don't want to do a fourth step because I don't want to do the fifth. And my sponsor said, you're in the fourth, just do the fourth. Worry about the fifth when we're in the fifth. And, you know, some things that I was afraid of revealing about myself to anybody else, some things that I didn't understand, you know, that fear, that 100 forms of fear, and I wasn't comfortable sharing that with anybody. And you know, 35 years later of alcohol, drugs, you know, all the rehabs, the street, and all the things I'd done, I was so disconnected from who I think I thought I was anyway that it was a mystery, you know. And in the steps, I found out some truths about me. I was honest and thorough, and I continued to do my best at that. And I found out that, you know, who I really was, and it wasn't who I thought I was all that time. It wasn't who I thought I was protecting. And it was in those moments, those revelations and those conversations with my sponsor and a couple of close guys, Frank, and a couple other people that were really close at that time, that I began to, you know, smash. My ego was being smashed, right? That's that ego that comes up that protects me. It tells me that story about who I think I am, and it tells you, and it projects all these things to protect that thing in me that I think needs protecting. And it was then when that thing was just getting hammered down because I was vulnerable and at a time when I really needed it. And that's what it took for me to get connected to what you guys were doing, to hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to be broken down, and I had to understand what you were saying, and that's what it took. It wasn't until then that I really began to hear what the message of Alcoholics Anonymous was, the way that I need to hear it. And I began to, you know, to get into the steps and really go into this thing. And by the time I was a year sober down at that mission, I ended up taking a job down there, and I realized, like, you know, if I was going to ever do this, that I needed to do it completely. I took a job at that mission, and I stayed there for years, 5 years. I was down there. Just doing the thing every single day, the way that group did it. I did a lot of meetings, did a lot of the things that they do, and I stayed sober. And that wasn't a plan of mine. I didn't think anything about that one way or the other. Probably about 5 years sober, Well, when I was about 2 years sober, I was telling my sponsor that I wanted to go home. You know, it's like, I'm done down here in L.A., and I'm ready to go home. He's like, I don't think so. I'm like, no, you don't? And he's like, no, I don't think you're done down here. I'm like, huh, okay. And I stayed, and you know, I was, that's where I was at in willingness to do what I had to do to stay sober, was I was listening to this guy in a way that was like, if I don't, I have these alcoholic ideas, and if I don't let another alcoholic know those things, man, today I'll go run and jump off the cliff. I'm thinking I've got a good idea. And you know, I'm grateful he said that to me when he did, and I stayed another 3 years down there. I learned a lot. I was a public spokesperson for this mission, and I was being interviewed a lot on TV. And I'm nobody special, but I know that that experience, what it taught me was, like, I was talking a lot about the people that were homeless on Skid Row in a way that was like, look at these idiots. And it was a good thing for me, because my perception changed and I realized I was one of those idiots. And then it was like, no, I know because I came here like that. And that was a moment of honesty, like real, because I didn't have to do that. I was in a $500 suit. My hair was, you know, whatever, all the things. And I could have just pretended that wasn't me. But identifying with that in a different way really kept it real for me. Like, I'm a Skid Row alcoholic and a gutter junkie. And don't forget that. And I try not to. I try not to forget that at all, because I come to meetings and you guys remind me that I'm an alcoholic, and I need to remember that, because I'll forget. I got a good forgetter. I got a really good forgetter. And I'll go out there and I'll, you know, one day, I believe it to be true, my head will get loud enough and the only relief I can find is in a drink, because I know it works. And so I haven't had to think about a drinker, not drinking in a long time. I don't, that obsession's been lifted from me. And so we have this obsession and this allergy, and I know if I don't pick up and get on one, then I'll be safe and I won't drink. But I have this spiritual malady, and I didn't know that that's what I really needed to address. Like, I get removed from the alcohol long enough, and I got this spiritual condition. And that was a big obstacle for me, because, you know, the big God in the sky was, you know, where my resentment laid for the death of my parents all these years. And I remember, you know, I'm a victim. I'm a good victim, right? Like, how could you, if you, you know, I got a lot of free beers and whiskey, saying, if you saw what I saw when I was a kid, oh, get them a drink, you know. I love to be a victim, because that just makes you always at fault for anything I'm doing. If you don't love me, you don't love me enough. You know, if you give me something, it's not enough. I need more, because that's not enough. Don't you know? And so I did that a lot, and I kind of understood that at some level, but I didn't realize the depth of my resentment at the higher power of my youth. And I just put that in my fourth step and found my part in that relationship, and it was that easy. It was that easy to see how my part in that relationship caused so much damage. And so I told my cousin, I remember, you know, when I was doing that fourth step, how proud I was. Like, I did my fourth step, I did my fifth step. And he's like, well, when you start making amends, you can tell me about it. I'm like, ooh, amends. I don't want to do that. And I still don't want to do that. I think there's a lot of times when my behavior is governed by the idea that I may have to come back and make amends later if you keep talking. So I'll try not to keep doing that, because I don't want to come back here. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to lie today because I don't want to come back and tell you, oh, that wasn't true. But I did. I went out and I did, you know, make those amends to the best of my ability, and I continue to do it. And I've told this story, my friend Bishop, no, but I used to travel home to Bishop from L.A., and you'd go to Vons, and everybody's shopping on Saturday and Sunday morning in Vons. There's only one, right? And I would creep around the corners looking to see, like, if there was somebody I knew, and I didn't want to go there because I was bouncing to somebody like, I'm willing. And when I crossed this bridge with my brother, who I have a tumultuous relationship with still. And the first time he came to visit, I'm like, telling my sponsor, like, fuck that guy. You know, you don't know what he did to me, da 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 da. My sponsor just does this. He gives me about a minute or two, and then he'll get into like, well, did you make your amends? What? To him? Do you know what he did? And in that process, he's like, well, did you read step 8 in the 12 and 12? And I'm like, ugh. Yeah. And it was in that process, and getting into step 8 and being willing to make amends to all the people, not just the list in my four step. That's a good start. Those are all the people that I want to feel good about making amends to, right? It's the top 10. It's all the same top 10. Mom, dad, brother, sister, you know, God, the judge, it's all the same top 10. It's all the people I hate. But those are the ones that are going to make me feel good if I make amends to. It's all these other ones I'm like pretending, like the lady, that checker at Vons. Man, I owed her an amends too. I owed Vons an amends that I paid in a donation where it says, would you like to make a donation? My sponsor said, yep. I'll tell you when to stop making that donation. And I just made donations to that every time I was in there for like my first 3 years. Every time I went to Vons, they said, would you like to make a donation? Yes. But then I got to a place where I was willing. I was willing just, and I'm willing today. If I see him, like, we good? I know. Do I owe you money? And that's the way it went. And that Vons shopping center, that Vons store was really good at just demonstrating that I had a program of action, that I could walk in there without fear. And if there was someone that I knew owned amends, I made it direct on the spot. And that was a turning point, again, another turning point in my program, in my relationship to Alcoholics Anonymous, in my willingness to do what my sponsor was suggesting. And ultimately in my relationship with the higher power. My higher power experience is, I don't know, it's not standard. I don't know what it is. I know that I grew up with one that I resented tremendously, that I blamed for all the things wrong in my life. And I know that when I got into the process, it talks a lot about just being willing to admit that there's something bigger than me, and that's enough to get going. And so I use that, right? And I'm like, I stayed up for too long on a particular Jones and read Carl Sagan's Cosmos all the way through, right? And so I'm like, no, God is superfluous. We're just stardust. We don't need a higher power. And so I like this tangible thing that I can grab on and say, this is God. And I know now that when I'm able to do that, when I'm able to understand my higher power, I'm already my higher power and I'll get loaded because it's not big enough to keep me sober. And I've had to learn that lesson over and over. We're talking about step 6 and 7 where I'm like, are you ready to give everything away? No, I'm ready to give most things away. Like, I know that I can't drink. You can have that, God, all the time. And I know that that's worked for me. I haven't had a drink since I've done that. My experience with the higher power and turning my will and my life over there to that higher power, my understanding is it's experiential. I know that since I took the action, I haven't had a drink. That's what I know about that. And that's been enough for me. I tried to enlarge my spiritual life. I'll tell this story real quick. I know that, so I go in and out of different churches. I've spent a lot of time in a spiritual seeking. Whenever I was about 8 years sober and I was just left a meeting in the park and I was on my way home and I stopped by an old church, the church I was raised in. And I was just like, I don't know. Kind of looking at the schedule, right? And I hear this, and I'm like, really? Is that what we're doing today, God? And I could see Father Gracie, he was over there sitting. It was confession time. I was like, really? Is that where we're at? Is that what's happening today? And it had been a long time. Like, I'm used to confess, like these little cedar boxes, you know? You're kind of peeking through, like, what are they doing in there? And who's listening? And it's all kind of like, and here was this bright, sunny room, and I could see his feet kind of just wiggling. He was sitting there. I'm like, what the hell? Here we go. And I went in there, and forgive me, Father, I have sinned, you know, and I did the whole thing, and I started to talk to this guy, and I let him have it respectfully, you know, had this conversation, like, here's what this thing did, and this is why, and da-da-da-da. I said, I've been a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time, and I've been praying. I'm not quite sure to what, but I've been praying, you know, and I told him this whole story, but your God took my parents, you know, this kind of thing, and we're having this little conversation, and he goes, and yet here you are. I'm like, here I am. Wow. Yep, here I am. And he told me to do the, you know, the five Our Fathers and the five Hail Marys, and I hadn't done that in a long time. I'm not recommending the church. I'm just saying my experience. And I went out and I did that, and I went every day after that for another 3 years, every morning. And I felt connected to the ritual. And that was enough to continue to make my higher power relationship, to continue to expand my spiritual experience through prayer and meditation as I understood it. And it was enough to keep this unknowable thing mysterious enough and out of my reach. Because if I get a hold of it, then I'm going to be God again. And I don't want that responsibility. It's too much responsibility. And I don't want you to be my God. It's too much responsibility for me to give you, right? I don't want a person to be my God. I don't want things to be my God. I need to have this unknowable, unattainable journey that I can always aspire to get closer to. I don't go to that church anymore for whatever my situation, my schedule's changed, I got a new job, or whatever. But it was a profound moment where I began to understand some things about me and this journey with peace. He told me that, I was talking about praying for patience. I pray for patience all the time. And he said, why do you continue to pray for patience? God's going to give you an opportunity to practice that virtue and you don't have it. And he said, pray for peace. Pray for peace. And then when those things happen, you'll be in a position to handle whatever is in front of you. And it dawned on me, that's what I was chasing from my sponsor. When he gets on the phone, I'm at peace. I just know. I can see him nodding his head. I can relate to where he's at. I know that when I'm operating from a place of fear, which is my normal, my go-to, restlessness, irritability, discontented. When something happens to me, my behavior is going to be related to that. And I know when I operate from a position of peace, that I am less likely to act out in behavior that's going to make me have me coming back to give you an amends. So that was a profound moment for me too. I have a life that's really good today. Single dad, raised my kid. She's doing really well. She's been a kid in Alcoholics Anonymous. She's come to give me cakes here. She practices the seventh tradition, right? Always send her out with money, pay your own way, go be a service to your grandmother. She understands these AA-isms that I had to relearn here. And I have a full life. I know that it's not about stuff because I've had all the things and been miserable, and I've had absolutely nothing, been destitute, homeless, and it's the same spiritual bottom. And so I'm grateful here to you guys. That's probably enough out of me. I could keep talking. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I won't. I'll keep talking. But I will say that, if you're new or used in Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope you find what I found. I know that I came here to scoff, and I have remained to pray. So thanks for letting me share.